Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We're talking today with a young man who may be a rising star in Missouri politics. Bruce Franks took his Ferguson activism to the political arena and found himself in a successful underdog fight with some local political heavyweights, winding up wresting the 78th District State House seat from Penny Hubbard. With those battles behind him, what's he thinking about his political future, the big issues, and his high marks as a first-term politician? Representative Bruce Franks joins me in studio. Great to have you with us. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know, I'm interested in getting your first impressions of this first year and find out, were there any surprises for you when you finally got down to Jefferson City and took that seat? Anything surprise you?
Yeah, what surprised me was the fact that everything didn't pan out like everybody said it was. You know, I went in there with my shoulders pretty high, like, as if it was going to be kind of a war, you know, between two sides. But it's all about relationships and communication. So actually being going down there and being able to actually communicate and get stuff done across the aisles was surprising to me. But I've always been wanting to, you know, try to bridge gaps. Mm-hmm. So they just talked about how hard it would be and how much we wouldn't get done. And I really feel as the freshman legislators and as a caucus as a whole, we got some things done.
Was there any difficulty in the urban-rural divide? And we talk so much about that with the legislature. Any problem communicating with the folks from the rural areas?
So actually, no. We have our difference of opinions. We see things differently. But we have to learn how to respectfully disagree with each other and still listen. And that was one thing that, one thing I'm proud of that we were able to do, that I was able to do, is really talk about the rural-urban divide and, you know, what goes on in this area and then listen to what goes on in the rural areas. And for me to learn what disenfranchisement looks like in places where it ain't a lot of folks that look like me or grew up like me or even think the way that I think.
It's not only a situation, the disenfranchisement, if you will, or poverty for that matter.
Absolutely.
Is not just limited to the urban areas.
No, absolutely. We went on a 2-week bus tour at the beginning of our, of the session as freshmen. And to go in some of these places, towards the Boot Hill and different parts of Missouri and to learn what the unemployment rate is and, you know, the level of poverty. When you come from the city, that's not what you're thinking about Republicans or rural areas. So to go down there and see it face to face and head on, that kind of opened my eyes to, you know, to a different life.
So it changed you.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What do you make of your own accomplishments, and what do you feel they were during this first year? It's tough for freshmen oftentimes, as I'm sure you know, to really have their voices heard.
I'm very pleased. I'm very pleased with my first session. Of course, I couldn't have did it without, you know, the entire team, the entire caucus, and even some of the Republicans, you know, most of the Republicans, actually. But I'm extremely proud of what I was able to get done. Not satisfied because you always want to push for more. But getting the millions of dollars in for summer jobs and being able to add amendments on the bills that, you know, bring forth accountability to the police, as well as being able to co-sponsor some successful bills and even just being able to speak on the floor and have folks listen to your truth and your point of view and really take it in. I feel like it was, you know, it was pretty successful.
Do you have any sense that you as a freshman were able to accomplish more perhaps than other freshmen in the past?
So that's been said. I don't like to say it. that's what's been said. I'm a humble dude. I just want to do the work, you know, do the work of the people. It was a pretty amazing year, you know, if I could say so myself. But a lot of folks did come to me and say, hey, you know, you've done some great things as a freshman that we haven't seen. And so that makes me feel good about not only the work, the push, and the fight, but the relationships that I've been able to build.
Do you think one can be, and I don't mean you necessarily, but one can be more effective on the political level or more effective on the streets?
So I think it, I don't think it's a either or. A lot of folks told me that when I decided to run, that, you know, you're more effective out here, when really you could be just as effective either one. It's really the work you put in and how far you're willing to go and how much you're not willing to take. Because on a legislative level, you know, I couldn't put millions of dollars in the summer jobs program from the street level. Mm-hmm. And some of the programs that I created on the street level, I couldn't do as a legislator. Mm-hmm. So I think they really go hand in hand with each other. And I think it's really room for both to really get the job done as long as we keep combining those fights.
Why is the summer jobs program so important to you?
So the summer jobs program, it provides jobs to, you know, some of our most at-risk youth in not only the city of St. Louis, not only the city of Kansas City, but the entire state in our rural areas. It's a program that not only concentrates on jobs, but we talk about financial literacy, financial empowerment, and specifically here in St. Louis, it's such a robust program that really brings forth police community relationships and, you know, political engagement and all these different things from, you know, folks that come from a community like mine who just, you know, wouldn't think of being engaged on this level. And it's just such a dynamic program. It helps the small businesses out. It helps, you know, the community out. It's putting more money back into the economy. Is teaching workforce, like it's such a great program that to think that it was cut at the beginning of the year and we could possibly not have it would definitely add to, you know, the crime rate and what's going on.
Well, that was a kind of a 1-2 punch with the cuts in that program and then the uncertainty over the minimum wage, which now has been cut back.
Yeah,
that's another one of your issues that I know is a big disappointment to you.
Oh, absolutely. You as a legislator, you gave us the power to raise our minimum wage. You said if you can raise your minimum wage in this amount of time, then you're grandfathered in. That's fine. And we did it. And to go through that fight and all of the organizations that put, you know, blood, sweat, and tears into this and, you know, just the folks on the street and the low-wage workers and everybody who, you know, really just went to bat and won. And just for the legislature, you know, the legislature to come and say, you know what, no, you know, we're going to take it back. It was really, it was a real slap in the face. And you just, when you talk about local control, you begin to see that that only counts for when the majority wants it, mm-hmm. you know, wants it to count. We created this for a reason and we were able to do it. And for them to take it back, you know, that was one of the biggest blows next to SB 43.
Will you come back at it next year?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. We, you know, whether it's trying to fight for statewide, because that's what they say they will support. Mm-hmm. So let's see. Let's hold their feet to the fire and see if that's true.
You know, I brought up the issue of summer jobs and minimum wage early on because, as you've already indicated, these are things that contribute to certainly to poverty, but also to crime.
Absolutely.
And the governor, just the last couple of days, has released his anti-crime bill. And I know that you have reacted to that very quickly and outspokenly and basically said that he doesn't get it. Because he doesn't understand these other components we've just talked about.
Absolutely. When he rolled out this unprecedented, you know, plan that he has that's actually been done before, he talked about the Mission Save. We just did that a year and a half ago. We've done everything that he's, you know, that he rolled out in his plan. And for him to come and do all of these terrible things that he's done by vetoing HCB3 and rolling back minimum wage and signing the discrimination bill, then you come to the north side of St. Louis with the hugest police presence and say, I'm here to help y'all. Mm-hmm. I'm here to fix crime, when we all know that the root causes of crime can't be fixed with this over-enforcement. And it's just, he doesn't get it. And he's been invited to the 78th district. He's been invited to other neighborhoods. Why don't you come down now before it's time to campaign? You know, show up in these communities, talk to these folks, talk to some of the low-wage workers. You know, go through a day, you know, in their shoes and see if you can, you know, see if you could survive. See, how does that, you know, how does that resonate in your mind? And he's just, you know, he's just not willing to do it.
Well, he's a Republican and you're a Democrat, of course. Do you feel that this is the same guy who ran for office? I've asked this question of others before, or that he's a different person now than he was as a candidate.
So I think he's a different person as he was as a candidate. And I know what the paper says. The paper says he's a Republican. I don't know what he is. He's shown that he's not willing to really take forth in bipartisanship. With the veto of HCB3, that was something that, you know, the Senate had been a bust all year.
And that is which one, just so our listeners understand?
Yeah, that's House Committee Bill 3 that basically they found the funds, $34.5 million, I think, or right around $35 million to keep the services, the in-home services for our disabled and our elderly community. You know, they found those funds, you know, and it was something that, you know, Deb Lavender and a few others were really pushing on the House side. And the Senate said, you know what, we're going to come up with this fix together. And it was Republicans and Democrats came back over to the House. We voted on it. It passed. Obviously, this has bipartisan support. These are the folks who represent the folks of Missouri. You know, these are the representatives and the senators who've come up with this plan to say, hey, this is what we need, Governor. And you basically overhaul all of that, what everybody's thinking, what everybody fought for and said, you know what, I'm going to veto this bill. What does that say?
Do you sense any areas of potential improvement in your relationship and the party's relationship with the governor and governor in particular?
At this rate, I don't see it. I'm willing to work with anybody. If my fight deters you from working with me or from actually even having a conversation, then that's some things that, you know, you got to kind of reevaluate yourself, because I'm passionate about fighting for the people. I'm passionate about the community in which I represent and the communities which I don't represent. You know, I'm passionate about people as a whole. So if the things that I say or do upset you to the point where you don't want to move the ball forward for Missouri, then that's a problem. But I'm going to continue to do the work. No matter who's governor, no matter what position he's in, or no matter what he says. So,
we are talking with State Representative Bruce Franks about his freshman year in the Missouri State Legislature. It's been an active year for him and for the legislature and for the governor. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with State Representative Bruce Franks of St. Louis. He represents the 78th District, and he has just completed his freshman year in the state legislature. Bruce, coming back to the issues that are most important to you, if you could wave a magic wand down there, we've already talked about jobs and we've talked about more income. What else is necessary to get the most disadvantaged of us up to an acceptable level, if you will, in terms of fitting in every way?
Realistically, I think livable wages are one of the most important things that we could really push for. 'Cause one thing that I heard was that these jobs that you make minimum wage aren't the jobs that's meant to feed a family off of. But when your community only have these low wage jobs, when there's so many challenges and barriers to this is how you have to raise a family. My mom raised us on White Castle paychecks for 4 to 5 years, you know, me and my brother. And so, you know, being able to recognize that folks need livable wages and folks just need a little bit of help. But when we're cutting so many different things, when we're not truly fully funding our school formula, We talk about education, and we had a route to fully fund our school formula, but it's not funded at what it has been or what it was supposed to be. And so it's, you know, with education and just bringing everything full circle to the root causes of poverty. If I had one magic wand, it would just be like the three components of just really education, jobs, you know, and really police community relationship, you know, bringing forth some accountability as well when it comes to our law enforcement across the state.
What are you looking for in a new police chief in St. Louis? The search is on. Are there certain qualities that you think are really, really important for this community?
Yeah, I think the police chief has to understand that St. Louis is unique. We do have crime like, you know, some of the other cities, but St. Louis is just a unique place. And you have to understand every single part of St. Louis. You have to understand the history of St. Louis. You have to understand the racial divide within our city as well as within our department. So we need somebody who's gonna stand up and do things differently, and not the old way, not the good old way, but actually get in here and talk about accountability, talk about racial disparities, talk about the disenfranchisement and challenges within the community. And you know, be innovative and creative in the way that we're doing things. We know that the police are here to enforce, but community policing and community engagement can help, you know, turn our city around.
It sounds like what you're talking about is a homegrown police chief, somebody who's understands the community.
Yeah, and so for the most part, I am. Mm-hmm. I wasn't opposed to a outside chief coming in. Talking to officers and talking to, you know, a good portion of the community, especially the officers, officers I've talked to, it's kind of hard to have a chief come in here when for one, you're going to have to pay them a lot more than what we pay our chiefs, and to come in and kind of fix our problems. Right. So what does that do for the morale of those officers? You know, we already have issues. We already have a disconnect within the community. Our officers are overworked and underpaid. Nobody disagrees with that. But we also got to attack these other issues, because when you're in a community that sees officers a certain way, it's kind of hard for them to feel like these officers need to get paid more, you know.
Sure.
So we got to kind of fix that. But I think a homegrown police chief that understands those things is more important than anything.
You're supportive of the mayor's removal of the of Chief Dotson?
So, no. And I'll tell you why. It was a growing consensus that a lot of folks wanted Chief Sam Dotson out of there. I think it was the way she went about doing it. And if you were going to bring in, somebody new, in my opinion, it makes sense to kind of make that transition a little smoother. But as the mayor, you have that, you know, you have that right. And that's one thing that all of the candidates talked about was removing Dotson when they first got in. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily, you know, disagreeing with the removal of Dotson. It's more so just how it went.
The manner in which it was done.
Absolutely.
She also seemed supportive, although there was maybe a little if there, of the governor's crime plan that we talked about, a little anti-crime plan that we talked about a little while ago.
And that, I think, again, that speaks to, a leader in the government that doesn't necessarily understand the components of certain communities. Crime prevention looks different in certain communities. Crime is an overarching issue that we all agree on, but over enforcement and police presence is what some of our more affluent communities would like when that begins to happen near their community. In other communities, yeah, we want more police, but we want police walking the streets. We want police meeting people. We want, we want resources, you know, driven into the community. We want our rec centers back open and satellite offices within our rec centers and all these different things. So depending on where you live, that looks different. And we have to have leaders that truly understand that.
Why did you decide not to run for mayor? There was a time when it was being talked about possibly as a write-in candidate. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide not to do that?
I decided not to because now in the House, we've had a seat. We've had a Senate seat that's been open all year. We're just about to fill one of the House seats down in, I believe, the 50th district. But we fought hard for that seat in the 78th district. You know, the community came together. We ran three races, you know, to get there. So for the people not to be represented, you know, for possibly an entire rest of the session and maybe next session until 2018, that wasn't acceptable. There were a lot of rumors that went out to say, oh, you know, it was the governor, it was this, it was that. Nobody's going to stop me from doing what the people pushed me to do. And when that came around, when that idea came around, the folks of St. Louis, all across St. Louis, were pushing me to run. Mm-hmm. They were pushing me to run as a write-in. They felt like if anybody could do it, we could do it. Mm-hmm. And it was something I honestly was ready for, because I don't get caught up in political aspirations. Mm-hmm. I get caught up in actually fixing what's going on. And we had folks that were like, oh, well, what makes you ready for, you know, mayor? Mm-hmm. I've worked with every single office in the city of St. Louis. I've created programs with every single office in the city of St. Louis. I've been in all of these communities. I've been here for 33 years. Whether I'm 33 years or not, doing anything for 33 years makes you somewhat well-versed. So,
is that something that might be in your political future, though? Is that something you would entertain?
I would. I'm just not being on a state level now. And being in Missouri, going to D.C. is not an option. I'll say that because I think it's so much to be done here. So many, so many gaps to be bridged and relationships to be made and work to be done. But I really like being in the legislature. I really like being in the House. And so I think moving up on a state level was more in my eyes.
While we're talking about politics and elections and such things, I'm curious as to what your take is on the voter ID law, which has just gone into effect for the first time in the city of St. Louis. And also, if you have thoughts on the fact that the government now is seeking voter data information to be sent to Washington.
So the voter ID law is terrible. It was something I spoke out against even before I was a representative, you know, during my race, because we had those issues. I've said this since the beginning of the session. What I see in Missouri, especially from the majority party, is the fact that they are creating great solutions for problems that we don't have. We don't have a voter impersonation problem. We don't have a voter fraud problem. So why are we putting more challenges and barriers in front of folks to keep them from voting? I'll tell you a quick funny story. So we went to play basketball, and Eric Schmidt, our treasurer, who Eric's a good guy. I like Eric. Our treasurer, we get to the place, and the lady asks us for our IDs. So we, you know, I pull out my ID. Mm-hmm. Representative Ellington pulls out his ID, and Mr. Schmidt's like, oh, I don't have my ID. Uh-huh. And the lady was like, well, you know, I don't know you, you know, and I need your ID. Mm-hmm. And they're like, listen, this is our state treasurer. He's, you know, he's been in the legislature, blah, blah, blah. She's like, I don't know him. Mm-hmm. You know, he was like, he looked at us and he's like, that's why you need your ID. I said, no, now you know what it feels like to be disenfranchised. And so it's just such a, you know, that push on that bill was just, it's just really hurtful to add these challenges and barriers, you know, and keep people from, you know, voting and to suppress the vote. And I honestly feel that's what it is. This was a national push. A lot of states, you know, in the past couple of years have really been pushing hard on this. And we know that this is one thing that's been pushed by ALEC heavily. Yes. you know.
Which is the group that really influences legislatures all over the country with proposed legislation and legislative suggestions and things of that kind. But what about, you know, Jay Ashcroft, the Secretary of State, seems willing to send voter information to Washington to this special commission that's been established to maintain, quote, integrity in elections.
And which it's just so funny and it's just so funny and contradictory that now we have Republican officials willing to send information when they are really strong about personal information. They're really strong about invasion of privacy and all of these different things and government information and government overreach and all these different things. And, you know, it seems that this is government overreach at, you know, almost at the max. Mm-hmm. We just don't have these issues. And for you to be willing to give that information up, if it's already public issue, if it's already public information, let them come get it.
Of course, it was your primary battle against Penny Hubbard and the absentee ballot flap that some people cite as evidence of election fraud.
Yeah, and it's a difference between election fraud and voter fraud. Mm-hmm. But what was found in and I'll say this, what was found as far as the courts and the route we decided to push, there were irregularities in the process that the Board of Election used, that basically compromised the situation. So the folks who voted, they were themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have a voter impersonation mm-hmm. problem. Yeah. But to cite that is, and they told me that's what's going to happen. And I fought. But to cite my race, fortunately, but unfortunately, nobody ever cites it in front of me so we can have this debate. It's always, you know, somewhere else. But yeah, that was, that's totally untrue and not valid. Yeah.
The Hubbard family, of course, has had some political influence in this city for a while.
Absolutely.
You won decisively in that race. Do you have any contact with her in particular in terms of guidance, help in getting you launched in your first year in Jefferson City?
No.
Sometimes you ask questions and you know the answer already. One other area I wanted to get to, because I think this is relevant to the crime issue we were talking before, and that is we have a brand new circuit attorney in St. Louis, Kim mm-hmm. Gardner, who has promised to make a number of changes in dealing with crime and punishment in particular. What are your thoughts about that and her approach? Has she been there long enough for you to have any kind of an impression about what she's doing and how?
So I think that first off, I like Kim Gardner. I think that she has some programs and some ideas that will work, that are going to work. I think that we need to come together as a whole in the city of St. Louis and our officials and kind of rally behind our circuit attorney's office to kind of give that support. You know, when your budget's being cut, when you're trying to get community engagement and you're trying to streamline your office, you're trying to do all of these things and budget just getting slashed, it's kind of hard to move forward on some things. But I think that we got to get this communication together between our city offices, between the mayor's office, between circuit attorney's office, between the police department, and see how we can kind of mesh this together, because she has some great ideas for diversion. She has some really good ideas for, you know, alternatives, you know, alternative sentencing.
Yeah.
So that's the direction we need to be moving in. But we just got to bring it all together.
But of course, there's likely to be a little bit of a yin and yang between what she wants to do and what the Attorney General of the United States wants to do, restoring mandatory minimums and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Another person that just doesn't get it. Mm-hmm. It's sad that I think the best thing about it is that on the state level and the city level, when we're able to kind of create things the way we need to create them, that's why local government is so important, because that's what truly really affects what goes on in our community. So if we got these diversion programs, if we got these great programs that are keeping, you know, keeping folks out of the system, keeping kids out of trouble, we're not even getting to the federal level. We're not getting to anything that the Attorney General is trying to get done, because we're handling it at home. And that's why we need to concentrate more on our local and our state government rather than this debacle in Washington, D.C.
People might have a different attitude about all of this if they really recognize how expensive it is to put people away. Even if it's just awaiting trial, it's still an expensive proposition.
Absolutely. And the thing about it is I've ran into, you know, Republicans in the state legislature who, you know, I've worked well with when it comes to criminal justice reform and some of the ideas that they have. Representative Higdon, Representative Hansen, Representative McCarty, as well as Nick Schroer. I mean, these are guys who feel that, you know, criminal justice reform is needed. We need to raise the age. We need to do all these different things. We might not agree on a bunch of other things. Mm-hmm. That's okay. But this one thing that we agree on, we could push forward to try to get something done. So I think that's going to be one thing that we're able to push on, along with, you know, Representative Brandon Ellington, who, you know, really feels that criminal justice reform is key. So when we get two sides working together, there's, you know, the opportunity to advance is just amazing.
Yeah. We have to wrap this up, but I'm curious as to what your own legislative priorities beyond what we've talked about today are going to be when you go back, and also ask you about the special session. You're going to have to go back to work there pretty soon, aren't you?
Yeah. So as far as legislative, my priorities, good time credit bill for, you know, our inmates who are, you know, participating in certain programs, getting certain certificates to kind of get some of that time knocked off. That's one thing that I'm be adamant about next year. My HB 183, my Christopher Harris Day Youth Violence Prevention Bill, which actually passed through the House and went to the Senate, and it was on its way. Then, you know, because of bureaucracy and politics, it got taken off the calendar. And then a House resolution to identify violence as a public health epidemic, so we can start funneling any of these resources to where we need them, and we can look at, you know, crime and violence for really truly what it's for. And so those are just a few of the priorities. I got some more, but you know, those are going to be the ones I lead with. As far as special session, I had to choose my word, but it's amazing, you know, and not in a positive way. That, you know, we have somebody who prides themselves on being fiscally responsible and, you know, caring about Missourians and all these different things. And you're wasting taxpayers' money by undermining the legislative process. These bills came through the House. They came through the Senate. They didn't make it. Period. Come back next year. That's just part of the process. And to do this and really ruffle feathers of not just us, it's easy to ruffle feathers of the Democrats, but to do this against your own party and to call us, you know, to kind of undermine us and call us names and tell us, you know, elementary school kids and we're career politicians. We're not the ones who, you know, had a presidential website before we were in governor or representative. So, you tell me who the career politician is.
But plus, it's not cheap to have.
Not cheap at all. It's roughly ran about $200,000 already, and we, you know, we got to go back in a couple weeks, and you know, God forbid he calls another one. But I don't know. He called another one. Might be a Royal Rumble up there. So
yeah, well, there are some suggestions that could happen, too, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to have to end it there, Bruce Franks. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on a good first year. You caught a lot of eyes with your performance there. And we'll look forward to see what's ahead.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me anytime. Just let me know.
Great to have you with us. Thank you so much. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.